every Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. on 94.1 KPFA with Wendell Harper and Amanda Elliott. Don't miss your opportunity to get the real story first.
And it is 5 p.m. here at 94.1 FM, KPFA, KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno. Stay tuned for flashpoints following these news headlines with Eileen Elfenderry.
An administration official says President Bush will send the U.S. Congress a draft resolution tomorrow that would authorize him to take military action against Iraq if he deems it necessary. The disclosure came after Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld pressed Congress to take the lead in authorizing force against Iraq. Rumsfeld told the House Armed Services Committee that Congress shouldn't wait for the United Nations to act. Near the start of Rumsfeld's presentation, he was interrupted by the co-founder of San Francisco-based Global Exchange, Medea Benjamin, and another activist who chanted, "Inspections, not war." Police removed the two from the hearing room. State reports of pesticide poisonings among farm workers are on the decline, but labor advocates say tougher state laws and more enforcement are needed to adequately protect the people picking and packing crops. State figures show an average of 475 farm workers reported being poisoned by pesticides each year between 1997 and 2000. That's down from the previous years. Pesticide use regulators attribute the decline to tough new state laws, as well as widespread enforcement brought about in part because of strong activism in the state. But the United Farm Workers Union says enforcement is still far too lax, fines are low, and pesticide poisonings are grossly underreported. West Coast port employers today accused union longshoremen of staging a work slowdown and vowed to take defensive action soon that could include a lockout on the docks that handle more than half of U.S. trade. The Pacific Maritime Association said the slowdown began Monday at the Port of Long Beach. A spokesperson for the union, which has been engaged in contract talks with employers for 5 months, denied there had been a slowdown and said there simply weren't enough workers to fill the jobs. A wave of anti-Arab hate crimes after the September 11th attacks resulted in a 15% increase in hate crimes in the state, reversing what otherwise would have been a downward trend. Crimes targeting Arabs or those perceived to be of Arab origin were up 500%. The State Department of Forestry is warning there's a high danger of fire today and tomorrow in the North Bay and East Bay Hills. A spokesperson for the CDF said winds out of the north from 15 to 20 miles per hour and low humidity triggered the alert. And Berkeley's Chez Panisse and about 200 other restaurants, grocers, and seafood distributors have pledged not to buy, serve, or sell fish created by biotechnology. The FDA is considering an application to market Atlantic salmon genetically engineered to grow twice as fast as salmon raised on fish farms. I'm Eileen Alfander. I'll be back at 6. Stay tuned for Flashpoints.
Today on Flashpoints, Iraq says bring on the weapons inspectors. War Secretary Rumsfeld says bring on the war. We'll speak with former UN weapons inspector Scott Ritter about the latest twists and turns in the U.S. drumbeat towards war against Iraq. Also, Rumsfeld puts the lie to recent Bush statements that the end of the bombing of Vieques is in sight, and a major move today towards the reunification of North and South Korea. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. In testimony before Congress today, the Bush administration continued its drumbeat towards war, despite Iraq's willingness to let in the weapons inspector. Joining us to talk about these breaking developments about Iraq is Mr. Scott Ritter. Mr. Ritter was a former chief UN weapons inspector in Iraq, and we're happy that he is joining us again to talk about this. Scott Ritter, let me just give you some of the quotes from Donald Rumsfeld, who to him was a given that Iraq already has biological weapons and they're going nuclear. And these are some of the things he said. He said, no terrorist state poses a greater and more immediate threat to the security of our people and the stability of the world than the regime of Saddam Hussein. He said, the last thing we want is a smoking gun. A gun smokes after it has been fired. The goal must be to stop Saddam Hussein before he fires a weapon of mass destruction against our people. This is the Secretary of Defense testifying before Congress today, essentially saying that they definitely have the weapons.
Prior to the Iraqis agreeing to allow inspectors back in, we were engaged in basically a hypothetical debate. On the one hand, you had people who, like myself, said, you know, we know they haven't been fully disarmed, but, you know, we really don't know what they have. And before we go to war, we need to have someone demonstrate that there's a capability. And then you had others like Donald Rumsfeld who said, we can't wait, you know, the smoking gun might be a mushroom cloud, et cetera, et cetera. And my point is the time for that debate's over. The bottom line is the Iraqis have agreed to the international community's requirements to allow inspectors back unconditionally and give them unfettered access. So the crux of the matter right now should not be hypothesizing about what may or may not exist in Iraq, but sending inspectors in so that we find out for sure. And if, in fact, they have the capabilities that Donald Rumsfeld is talking about, then the weapons inspection process is the best way to deal with it. It's peaceful, nonviolent, and effective. So I don't see where he gets off rejecting this and pushing us in a direction where hundreds of thousands of Americans' lives are going to be put at risk, tens of thousands of Iraqis are going to be killed, billions of dollars of property destroyed, an entire region, indeed the world, destabilized, when we have a nonviolent key to opening this door here.
The word that was used many times today was definite. They definitely have the weapons. Is there a way for them to know that?
Well, I mean, they keep saying that. Is there a way for them to know that? Yes, there's a way for them to know that. So why don't they demonstrate the basis of their knowledge? The thing is, when I hear somebody say, we definitely know, and then they fail to back it up with fact, I start to question, their usage of the English language.
They use as one of the mantras since Iraq came out, it's almost like it's an attack from Iraq that they agreed to let the weapons inspectors come in. And they keep saying as a mantra, the goal isn't inspections, the goal is disarmament. I'm trying to understand that phrase.
It makes no sense. You can't have disarmament without inspections. This is where we're getting down to the crux of the matter. Prior to the Iraqis, and this is the reason why I went to Baghdad, frankly speaking, I told the Iraqis that they're going to lose the debate until they let inspectors back in. The bottom line is it doesn't matter what Iraq says it's done in the past. It doesn't matter if Scott Ritter or anybody else comes out and says that Iraq, you know, has probably been disarmed, that there's no evidence of them retaining it, etc. The fear of the unknown preys upon ignorance. And since September 11th, the American public has been susceptible to the politics of fear, the politics of the ignorant, and have been, you know, able to be readily convinced by speculative rhetoric that Iraq poses a threat worthy of war. And the Bush administration has capitalized upon this and exploited this and has generated political support for war against Iraq. Now, they've used the threat of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction to generate this support. But the fact of the matter is, it's never been about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. It's always been about regime removal, getting rid of Saddam Hussein, because neoconservatives who populate the Bush administration have invested a tremendous amount of political capital into that. They have boxed themselves into a rhetorical corner, demonizing Saddam Hussein to the point that they have given themselves no ability to maneuver. They have to remove Saddam, and having invested so much political capital, they will suffer if they don't. And weapons inspections threaten them, because when you talk about getting inspectors in, it's not just about finding weapons of mass destruction, but it's also about perhaps finding that Iraq is in fact disarmed. And if Iraq is disarmed, you now have engaged the machinery of international diplomacy where you might have to consider lifting sanctions in accordance with international law, thereby breaking the containment that has held Iraq back for over a decade now, causing tremendous suffering amongst the Iraqi people, but kept Saddam Hussein in check. And you have Iraq welcomed back into the family of the international community with Saddam Hussein at the helm, which is the exact opposite of what the Iraqis want. So you're looking for an explanation or a reason for why the administration's saying what they're saying. It's because They don't want inspectors in. They want to remove Saddam Hussein, and they're really confused now because the hypocrisy and the inconsistencies of their policies are being laid bare to the American public.
And Rumsfeld wants a decision from Congress before the UN Security Council votes on the issue. What's your response to that?
Again, I would advise Donald Rumsfeld to read the Constitution of the United States and then read the United Nations Charter and understand that we are a nation of laws and we are incorporated into a community of laws, an international community of laws. Iraq has a number of resolutions that have been passed already, setting down the law requiring disarmament. The president has rightly said Iraq is in violation of these. We don't need any more laws. The danger is that the Bush administration is pushing for a situation where they will clear the way for immediate action. They will predetermine the outcome, which will, of course, be regime removal, by stacking the deck against weapons inspections. And then the danger is they will manipulate the inspections in such a manner that they will provoke a crisis, and then they already have this automatic trigger in place against Saddam. That's now how it works. When you have a criminal and you're prosecuting a case against a criminal, the DA and the cops have to go by the law. You can't plant evidence. You can't come in and operate outside the framework of the law. You need a search warrant. You need judicial permission, etc. So that when you stand before the judge, it's the judge that makes the determination. The judge makes the determination after the investigation has been done. What Rumsfeld's trying to do in his testimony is make the determination before the investigation's done. That flies in the face of just legal procedure. It's incorrect. It's wrong. And frankly speaking, because the Bush administration is not honest in regards to the disarming of Iraq, because they have put regime removal ahead of disarming Iraq, we must question their motives for what they're trying to do. Let the inspectors in, Mr. President. Let them do their job. If Iraq fails to comply, then go to the judge, the Security Council, make your case, and I guarantee you the world will line up behind the United States to hold Saddam Hussein harshly accountable, and this will include decisive military action designed to remove him from power.
We're speaking with Scott Ritter. He's a former chief UN weapons inspector in Iraq. Finally, the Wall Street Journal today, in an article by Stephen Hayes, is really attacking you. They call it Ritter of Arabia. They refer to you as a PR spokesperson, a flack they're suggesting for Saddam Hussein. They're saying that you really flip-flop from your opinions in 1998. What's your response to this article?
Look, Stephen Hayes isn't a journalist. Stephen Hayes is a mud-slinging neoconservative hack. That's the bottom line. He works for the Weekly Standard. And the Wall Street Journal has done itself a disservice by allowing him to use their pages for his personal attacks on me. Stephen Hayes is not equipped to talk about the facts of Iraq or Iraq's disarmament. Stephen Hayes is an attack dog. His job is to try and assist those who want war with Iraq to direct people away from the message that I'm trying to send by attacking the messenger. And these are totally baseless attacks. But the thing is, when he puts them out there, now I have to spend my time defending myself, and I'm just not going to do that. Stephen Hayes is not a bother to me. I'm taking my message straight to the American public. I'm having a great success in doing so, and I'll leave it up to the American public to make the determination. I would just ask that before people judge me, that they review the record, that they don't rely on op-ed pieces written by anybody, let alone Stephen Hayes. Review the record. There's plenty of it out there. My Senate testimony is available online. My presentations are available online. My words are out there. Read it. See for yourself. Make your own judgment. You can disagree with me if you want. That's your prerogative. But at least take the time to study the facts and don't allow these kind of personalized attacks to interfere with your judgment.
Well, as I said, we have been speaking with Scott Ritter. He is a chief former UN weapons inspector in Iraq. He's the author of Endgame, Solving the Iraqi Problem Once and for All. I want to thank you again for being with us, Mr. Ritter.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Opposition to the war on Iraq is growing. Today in Washington, as Rumsfeld testified before Congress, protesters stood up to interrupt his pro-war speech with a call for peace and negotiation. Here's an excerpt of that interruption inside the chambers of Congress.
Is it the responsibility of free people to do something, to take steps to deal with such a threat before such an attack occurs?
Yes, Mr. Rumsfeld, I think we need weapons inspections, not war. Why are you obstructing the inspection?
And that was a bit of a disruption as Rumsfeld made his case to go to war. He's asking the Congress to grant the president the right to go to war even before the United Nations has a chance to meet in the Security Council and make a decision. Now, joining us live in the studio is Barbara Lubin. She's a longtime war resister. She is on her way to Iraq, and we wanted to sort of get her in to talk a little bit about that. Well, Barbara, the drumbeat is growing louder, and also the resistance movement is growing louder. Tell us a bit about why you're heading to Iraq now.
Well, I'm heading to Iraq with Voices in the Wilderness. Middle East Children's Alliance has worked with Voices in the Wilderness since 1995, when Voices started really getting involved in Iraq. This is my fifth trip to Iraq. I was there right before the first Gulf War. I was back again a month later with George Azar, traveled around, saw what happened during that war, and have been there twice since then, delivering millions of dollars of baby food and medicine. And I'm going this time to, number one, break the sanctions, to bring in medicine, to bring in, actually, I'm bringing in a huge number of the most beautiful finger puppets for children that a very wonderful friend, supporter of the Middle East Children's Alliance is sending along with me. And I'm going to go into the schools and to meet with the children, little kids and high school kids. I want to hear what they have to say. I want to bring back their voices and their faces and, let kids here in America in our schools see these slides, see who's there, really put a face on the Iraqi children. And I'm also going because Voice in the Wilderness, along with help from Middle East Children's Alliance, we're going to be setting up a permanent peace team in Iraq. And we're going to sort of scout it out and figure out how this is going to happen. But to have a permanent presence of North American people over there during this time and until the Iraqi people don't need us anymore. And, you know, we should have inspectors in there. We've had inspectors in there. I'm not sure that that's the answer, sending in more weapons inspectors. The weapons inspectors, Scott Ritter was one of them, they've been there. There is nothing left. It's end the sanctions. We need to end the sanctions immediately. The sanctions are what is killing the people there. And so I'm not sure where I stand on the sending in the folks again to look at, you know, to look for weapons. I think it's outrageous. I think that the Iraqi people, the Iraqi government, abided by those UN resolutions. They allowed those weapons inspectors in there. They were in there. And as Scott Ritter says, 99% of everything is gone. I don't think that's the issue. I think the issue is that this government is unbelievable. It is despicable. George Bush, Rumsfeld, and all of them, they are maniacs, and it is frightening to me that they're getting away with all of this. Iraq is a sovereign country. It has its leader. It has its people. We have no right to be in there inspecting anything. We have no right to be part of any sanctions, and we have certainly no right in overthrowing any leader of any country. It's against all international law. I find it just appalling.
People are concerned that this, like the initial attacks, 9/11 attacks, are going to have terrible negative ramifications for the Palestinians. We know that the situation is already terrible. We had Robert Fisk on the other day, and he was talking about the potential balkanization of Iraq, splitting Iraq up. Saudi Arabia doesn't go along with it, split up Saudi Arabia.
Right.
And he talked about Sharon sort of cheering along with the leadership there in Israel because there's real concern and thought that they will use the war as a cover to literally purge Palestine of Palestinians and send them into Jordan. Do you?
Well, I don't want to take it away from Robert Fisk, but I have to tell you that my partner Howard Levine has been saying that since this all started. That yes, this could very possibly, although there's no way of ever telling what's happening anywhere in the world, especially in the Middle East, it's always a crapshoot. But it could very well be the cover that Israel is looking for to get rid of the Palestinians. The word transfer has been around for 40, 50 years, because Israel would like nothing more than to transfer the Palestinian community out. And it's a worry. You told me today that the king of Jordan said that the Israelis will be met by force by the Jordanian army if they try to do this. You know what? I have heard those kinds of words many times from many leaders in that part of the world, and they all just sort of bow and bend over and let Israel do what it's doing. You know, it's really, it's a frightening time for Palestinians, really frightening.
Why do you think it's important to have Americans, people from this country, on the ground in Iraq now, as it really does seem that war is inevitable from the point of view of the U.S. Power elite?
Well, you know, I think that many of us who chose to go to Nicaragua and to El Salvador in the midst of those wars, with Witness for Peace and many other organizations that we were all connected to, we felt, and I think people in El Salvador and in Nicaragua felt very strongly, that that show of support, our being there, our being on the ground with them, showed this solidarity that no words could ever accomplish. And so we feel that Kathy Kelly and I and others feel that very strongly, that we need to be there. We need to be there with those people. We need to do what we can do to help people there. And we need to demonstrate as much as possible. And we need to, you know, raise our voices from over there and bring those voices over here. I guess that's it.
Well, Barbara, before I let you go, I'm just going to ask this question. Because it occurs to me every time I say goodbye to you in these situations that you could be hurt, people going there in a risky situation. Aren't you afraid of that personally?
Well, you know, I could joke and say what I usually say.
Don't.
It would be a mercy killing, but after all, it's keeping me from going to the Pacifica National Board meeting. I'd rather be in Iraq. But, no, I'm really not afraid. I'm going first to Iraq, and then I'm going to Palestine. I'll be gone for about 3 weeks, and I'll be calling in here. I don't know whether I can call in from Iraq, and I know we have a fundraiser, so I don't know whether that's possible. But, you know, over there, we're met with open arms by the Iraqi people. I'm met with much love and open arms by the Palestinian people and many in the Jewish peace movement in Israel. So I don't feel frightened at all, actually.
Well, we'll be
frightened. Maybe I just don't care.
Well, we're going to be thinking about you, and we will try and get in touch with you, Barbara Lubin. And if people want more information about the Middle East Children's Alliance, it's 510-548-0542. Barbara, good luck, and thank you very much. You're welcome. We have a beautiful new song by a local artist. It's called Peace Upon Our World. It's by Andrew Kung Knight and Julie McLean Knight. Listen to this.
Swallows an airplane, poison envelops the air. Oh, senseless, unimagined. Oh, my child just learned to crawl. Why can't we?
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. After 50 years of separation between North and South Korea, there is a historic construction underway today to pave the roads towards reunification. The two countries are simultaneously rebuilding two sets of railroads and roads that were severed during the Korean War from 1950 to 53. The roads are planned to reconnect across the demilitarized zone as early as November and a railroad by the end of the year. Joining us to talk about this historic reconciliation effort is Ramsey Lim. Lim is a professor of psychology at Boston College and the director of the Oral History Project on the Impact of the Korean War. He is also the founder of the Boston Korean Friendship Association, a new group that formed in response to Bush's Axis of Evil speech, which names North Korea as one of the biggest threats to U.S. security. Professor, it's a pleasure to have you on Flashpoints.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, tell us, what is the significance of this reconnecting of the rail and the railroad links across North and South Korea border, which President Clinton said was the most dangerous place in the world?
Well, I think your introduction covers a good bit of it. I think there are at least two important aspects of this connection. One is symbolic, and one, I suppose, is more practical. The practical side of it has to do with the possibilities for much more developed economic exchange, both between Koreans in the South and Koreans in the North, but also an opportunity for the Korean Peninsula to gain more economic significance in relation to its neighbors, Russia, China, and Japan. So it's very important from the point of view of the development, future development, and further development of the economic capacity, both in the North and in the South. The other aspect of it, the symbolic, is perhaps even more deeply significant, particularly for Koreans, not only in Korea, but also around the world. Because as your introductory statement said, it represents at least a serious beginning and concrete possibility that over a half a century of terribly destructive division of a nation with 4,000 years of history may, in fact, finally be coming to an end. And for Koreans who have watched from the United States for the past 30 or 40 years, in hopes that we might see a significant breakthrough in the process of reconciliation. Today is what might have even several years ago have been thought of as an impossible first step. But as a Korean American, I'm sure I share in the great hope that today really is a significant step towards the ultimate unification of the nation.
Right now, you cannot telephone call between North Korea and South Korea, vice versa. What is the current situation between the North and the South with respect to communications and road connections?
Well, as you know, until very recently, the opportunity for people to be in touch with each other has been virtually non-existent, aside from a half a dozen very brief reunions that have been permitted over the past several decades. Several of which have occurred within the past year. Koreans, by and large, have lived in separate worlds. But the roads and the railroads in the present moment not only open the doors themselves, but as you may know, last week, an agreement was reached between the North and the South for a permanent center where families who are divided can come and spend perhaps more than the several days that has happened in the past. Meeting each other for the first time in 50 years and renewing deep ties of blood. So while it's been relative, for example, to the German situation, an even more complete barrier between families in the Korean Peninsula, literally within the last week, we've seen dramatic changes.